As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello and welcome to the show. It's brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. Dan here from The Square Ball with Michael Normanton as well as Phil Hay from The Athletic, fresh from Jesse Marsh's pre-Accrington press conference, which we'll deal with momentarily. Show is twice a week until March. Friday edition is about the post-press conference chat, and we'll find out what Jesse said, and we'll kind of get into it in due course. Plenty of written coverage on Leeds United as well on The Athletic, theathletic.com/Leeds pod, to get the new year offer to read everything that Phil writes about, and you even get to interact with him. Can't look him in the eyes, but you can get to exchange words with him, written words.
Oh, you can. Yeah, no, I love people looking me in the eyes.
theathletic.com/Leeds pod to get on board with The Athletic. Right then, the press conference, the Jess conference, the FA Cup.
Yes.
Where should we begin then, Phil? We've got a bit of illness and injury. We've got some Cody Drame. Team selections for the FA Cup. We'll speak, I think, more depth about the FA Cup game towards the back end of the show. Deal with transfers in the middle bit. So where do you want to start in part one then?
Why don't we get into what you finished up talking about, which was tactics and width, and
I thought it was going to be what's your favourite shaped cup.
Well, that as well, yes. And didn't go for the Champions League European Cup, went for the FA Cup. I personally think the Scottish Cup has a nicer shape than the FA Cup, but then again, I would. The stuff about
me and Dan have just both started frantically googling
just
Scottish
a
Cup.
Yes.
There.
Yeah, just before you go any further, we will.
And by all means, message in.
That is a handsome
fight.
It's a handsome
I'll
trophy.
Give the toss. It's also got a quality base on
I was just going to say the base is what makes it for me there, yeah. There are echoes of the FA Cup, but it's got bigger ears.
I think it may be older as well, but I could well be making that up. So no, not trophy shape. And mind you, having said that, in America, they don't have to make their trophies massive, don't they? Like the Stanley Cup in ice hockey always looks like you need about eight people to lift it. So they take that sort of thing quite seriously.
Can you imagine, you know? I mean, everything's bigger in the States though, isn't it? Like, could you imagine what they'd make of the Ashes?
Yeah,
Is it a tiny little urn?
Yeah, you'd have some crypto company going, make this 30 times the size.
It's reminiscent of, what's the film about the band with Stonehenge?
Spinal Tap,
yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. If you've seen that, you'll know what I'm referring to. If not, we'll move on.
Yeah, I was going to say, enough of this bollocks. Let's advance. I think it would be quite good to get into the conversation that he was having about tactics and with... and referencing, and it was him who brought this up, the list that people will probably have seen, the bullet points that someone took a photo of inside Elland Road, listing his principles, essentially, the crux of his football, how it works and everything else. And the part that he got onto talking about was the particular mention in it of minimal width, which was how that discussion started up.
Yeah, for anybody who hasn't seen it, keys to the game, wasn't it? Eight bullet points.
Of which you can quite easily apply them to the football that we're seeing. So fast starts, stay aggressive, minimal width, vertical, counter press, so on and so on. Shifting, pumping and defending forward.
You've been doing much pumping today, Phil?
Well, as it happens, John Muller, one of our stats guys, who knows far more about tactics and stats and data than I do. I mean, a hell of a lot of people know an awful lot more about a hell of a lot of things than I do. But on that specifically, John knows his stuff. So John got in touch with me and said, look, what is pumping? And I said to him, listen, just be careful on Google when you're digging around for this. However, the honest answer is I'm not entirely sure. And your natural assumption is that it's an American phrase, but John said could as easily be a Red Bull thing, a Red Bull reference, given that that Marsh has been through that system. And a contact of his, and I'm sure John won't mind me sharing this, said that it is basically the equivalent of stepping up. So the player who's closest to the ball moves towards the ball. And when that happens, others reposition so that they're ready to go in and interact with the press as well. That essentially is pumping, as it was described to us. Whether that's how Marsh sees it, I'm not entirely sure, but that was one definition, according to somebody who kind of knows about this stuff. But anyway, this was kind of laid out as the principles of Marsh's football, finishing with number 8, celebrate moments in the spirit of, I guess, what we've been seeing quite a lot of in football, particularly with defenders, of, you know, more and more celebrations of tackles and small wins, I suppose, in games. A little bit reminiscent of what you see in NFL when they sack the quarterback, pretending that I know what I'm talking about, but you know what I mean.
Absolutely, yeah. Pontus Janssen, Rasmus Christensen, we see it
from
them. Yeah.
Christensen is a good example. You've seen a lot of that from him, yeah.
So what do you make of the lack of width? That's the political hot potato, isn't it, around Leeds United at the minute? That he seems to obviously be very well wedded to the Red Bull system that plays more narrower than than other people might be used to or may favour.
Well, the way we got into this conversation was a little bit convoluted. It started with Chris Armas, who's joined as coach, assistant head coach to Marsh. Was at Manchester United last season. Again, worked at New York Red Bulls with Marsh and then coached them after Marsh in the States. So another kind of product of the Red Bull system, if you like. We got into a discussion about what Red Bull football is, you know, what the principles of it are. Marsh said to his mind, it's kind of more German than it is Red Bull, if you know what I mean. That it's applying a lot of principles that you see in German football as opposed to Red Bull having their unique system outside of that.
Can I say gegenpressing now? Is that appropriate?
In the sort of Jürgen Klopp spirit style-y.
I'm just trying to appear knowledgeable, Phil.
Yes, throw in little things like XG differential every now and again and you'll have people on toast. So from that point, I asked him, you know, what then has the Premier League taught you? And more to the point, what has it made you do differently or what have you felt like you should do differently? And he spoke a lot about how, or he got onto the subject of how a lot of coaches and a lot of clubs and teams at the top level in England follow the Guardiola model or follow a version of it, not the out-and-out Guardiola model, but, you know, the same sort of principles, the same idea, the same kind of style, which I think it's fair to say Marsh definitely doesn't. But from that point, it led on to discussion about width. And he was asked by a reporter from PA, what's the benefit of width, essentially, of minimal width? What is the point of a team having no width and what is it supposed to achieve? And I think what Marsh was trying to get at was that, as he sees it, the more bodies that you have in one position, and I think this links very heavily to counter-pressing. The more bodies you have in a position where you're trying to counter-press, the more bodies you have, A, to do the counter-pressing, but then B, to pick the ball up and to provide passing options as and when the ball comes to you and possession turns over. And he spoke again about, you know, the goal being in the middle of the pitch as opposed to the corners or the sideline, which he's talked about before, you know, so play kind of gravitating in that direction.
Do you think he'd do away with the corners, if he could? Maybe we could slice a big part of the pitch out.
Just make it a sort of rhombus or something, yeah. Something like that.
Go for a diamond.
It's an option. Get in touch with the Premier League. They tend to like that sort of stuff, don't they? Premier League anthem. Yeah, that can be your job. So, you know, that's very much how he sees it. He was saying that minimal width is a Guardiola principle as well, although I have to say that when I watch Man City play, the thing that strikes you more often than not is the fact that when they attack, they do tend to attack with the front five and they do tend to have a lot of width. And also it is Guardiola's trend to play with a right footer on the right side, a left footer on the left side, again, just to stretch the play. I suppose I'd have to watch City really closely in other aspects to see actually if there are points of the game where they use kind of minimal width. But it does seem to me that when you look at the way Leeds play, it's very, very different to the way that a lot of sides play in this division. It absolutely is. And I think where we're at now is that in order for this to come good for Marsh, it has to work. You know, it has to work. In order for this system to be vindicated and in order for him to be able to say, this is a valid method of approach in the Premier League, this is a valid method of trying to attack and defend, it needs to start delivering results.
When he started comparing the style to Man City, I was wondering if I felt like he was gaslighting me a bit. I was thinking, but they But Man City do play with width. They have the fullbacks pushed.
They hug the touchline.
They have the fullbacks pushed really high up, and then you've got normally got someone like Grealish or Bernardo Silva or Mahrez or Mahrez someone just, also.
Mahrez stands out really on the touchline. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the problems with City is that they commit a lot of players to attacking areas if they're attacking forward, but they do it in a totally different way to Leeds. So whereas Leeds can be really compact and quite congested, City do tend to spread this five across the pitch, and it's an absolute nightmare to play against because they kind of back themselves not only to be able to push that many players forward, but to be able to cover when they lose the ball and to be able to cope defensively. And they're extraordinarily well drilled, and they have the best players going, give or take, so that definitely helps. But there's so many players in attack that it's really difficult to mark, and it's really difficult to read, and it's really difficult to keep on top of, hence why Haaland keeps popping up and going bang.
I've got a question. I've raised my hand like I'm in school here because
yes,
I've got a question about this. Yeah, it doesn't translate that well onto the audio, but but just trust me, I did. But I watched Leeds against Brentford, and it seemed like Leeds were trying to force the ball through the middle, and it was like school football at times, the swarming around the ball and just not being able to... It was like they're trying to almost attritionally force the ball through in the defence. And then you look at spaces out wide and you think, if you put a man out there, even for a bit, and give him the ball, it gives him a bit more space to attack into. Like Willy Nonto, perfect example. If he's got space to run into, he's more effective perhaps than if he's tightly marked or he's got, you know, Jack Harrison holding his hand or whatever it might be next to him on the pitch. So is there not... I mean, I know I'm talking a really basic concept here, asking a really basic question, but is there surely not some merit in using space when it's available rather than just constantly trying to force the ball through a really, really congested area in the middle?
I was thinking about this after the game at the weekend, and Brentford on the one hand were really disciplined at the back and defended very well. But I think given the attacks that were coming at them, I think Thomas Frank would probably have been pretty annoyed if they'd been cut open by some of those. It's the thread of the needle thing that in certain circumstances is really difficult. But actually, when I look at some of the games and you think back through the games and the attacking positions that Leeds are in, it would be totally wrong to say that they don't have positions or don't get into positions in slightly wider areas where good deliveries can come from. But I don't feel, or to look at them and to look at the quality of the service that comes out wide, I don't think they're really drilled or really minded to deliver quality from those areas. I don't think they're set up, or I don't know whether it's a case of how they train or whatever else. But in wide areas, and this was the case against Brentford, what was developing out there was not really turning into quality chances in the middle. So again, you know, the Rodrigo shot is from central zone. Nonto's shot, okay, he's in the kind of wider section of the box, but it's still from an attack down the centre. I can think of moments when Ayling was out wide, Nonto in the first half, a lot of possession on the left, but it isn't coming to anything. And I think perhaps because that's just not the way they're drilled.
There were moments in that Brentford game when there were big crossfield passes that seemed to be quite effective. I don't know if you thought the same. When it would go from the left-hand side of the pitch, particularly in the first half, I'm thinking over to Ayling, who would be bombing on down the right. So we are using width in that sense, that the fullback is allowed to exploit the width. But then when we're in attacking areas, it doesn't feel like we're trying to stretch the defence.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, yeah.
Like, so the person who's then on the right is tucked right in, possibly even in that melee over towards where the ball is. So there's never that option of the out ball to the other side of the pitch. It's always trying to force it through that same area, a little interchange of passes, and it's not... It's had mixed results, hasn't it? Because we're not absolutely terrible by any stretch of the imagination, but you would sometimes like to see somebody look up and go, ah, there's a man in space there, because the Brentford tried to attack us using the same tactic. If you watch what they did, they'd attack down one side and immediately look to the far side to try and stretch the play.
Jesse did address the back post today again, didn't he? So he did it with a slight wry smile, I thought, when he was saying about... the question was about... It was your question, in fact, wasn't it, Phil, about what the Premier League has taught him, and he was basically saying that everyone's good, and and some people pass it to the back post and score. That's very much that's very much paraphrasing what he said, but that he did seem to slightly address it, I thought, today.
Yeah, Brentford, I thought, were massively direct at the weekend, to an extent that I didn't expect. It's not that they don't do that, and everybody kind of knows that that's what they do, but maybe it was just a reflection of the fact they didn't really get into the game properly or get on top of the game. Frank said afterwards he wasn't particularly delighted with the performance. It was funny digging through the defensive stats, which I did last week, to see that actually when it comes to set pieces and corners in particular, they're not that vulnerable, Leeds. They're nowhere near as vulnerable as I think a lot of us kind of feel that they are or think that we see. It's in open play that the problems develop, and they, more than most teams in the Premier League, are susceptible. If you look at the stats and the numbers that opt to record for this, they are more susceptible, I think, than about four or five other clubs to counterattacks and chances at the end of those counterattacks. So I think it's quite obvious where the weaknesses lie. But I mean, this is Marsh's style, and it's quite obvious, I think, that he's going to stick to it. And what I was interested to know from the question I asked was, you know, have you kind of changed the way you think about tactics, the way you think about football, the ideas that you see in the Premier League, as opposed to, say, the Bundesliga or the Austrian Bundesliga? Has it taught you anything new? But I still feel that the principles of the way that Leeds are playing are the same as they were when he first came in last February.
Do you feel like you got an answer to that question?
I think he didn't give any indication that he'd necessarily changed his train of thought or his philosophy. I think, if anything, it gave the impression that he was 100% prepared to stick to what he was doing and to trust that it's going to work. And as I say, I think that's where he's at now. It kind of has to work, doesn't it? If this is going to work, then it will. If it isn't going to work, then it will come to an end.
And it feels like, I guess, that's the kernel of it, if you like, of where he's at in terms of his managerial reign now, heading into this crucial spell of fixtures, looking for a method to start working that we're not quite sure that it's got merits in it, but it needs to deliver now.
Well, better players will help. So if Jorginho Rutter is as good as we hope he's going to be and as good as he's been, as, you know, mentioned in dispatches from Hoffenheim make him sound, then he will add to the attacking line. He'll bring a little bit more threat. He could be a really valuable asset in the second half of the season. People will have seen the links to Weston McKennie, and we've spoken before about Azzedine Unahi at Angers as well. I think if Leeds do a central midfielder before the end of the window, then it's another string to the bow, without a doubt. You have to say, though, that there is the feeling of the club backing Marsh at every turn, and I think that was certainly apparent with Chris Armas coming in. We reported over the summer that Armas was going to be his number two, and then, for personal reasons, Armas didn't arrive. It was Rennie Maric who came in as Marsh's assistant instead. We were told, and I haven't spoken to Armas about this, so I can't say for sure, but we were told that Armas was none too happy with the way, with, I think, the coverage and the narrative around him at Manchester United. There was one story in particular which I was told had upset him, which was, you know, the story saying that players were comparing him to Ted Lasso, and Marsh kind of brought that up today, saying that moniker passes from me to him now. Yeah, it was just a joke, but, you know, that was kind of part of what was being said and being talked about at Manchester United. And the feeling seemed to be that he hadn't enjoyed that experience of the Premier League and wasn't certain about staying in it. I can't say if that was absolutely the motivation, but he's here now, and he's the person who Marsh has gone back to since Mark Jackson went to MK Dons to manage them. And, you know, that combined with the signing of Werber, Rutter, you know, the other signings that have been made, the kind of commitment to this model and to Marsh's idea, makes it feel, you know, turn after turn, as if the club really, really do want this to work and have certainly not given up on it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
You mentioned Rutter there in part one, Phil. He's no longer our shiny new toy. We want another one. We want Weston McKennie from Juventus. Are we just wrangling over fees now? Is that where we're at?
A little bit like Unahi, and we've chatted about this a few times. There's obviously there's the matter of cost, which is a big factor in the transfer Leeds do. And I know that you would say it's a big factor in the transfers that any club do, but some clubs are more predisposed to having available cash than others. And without getting bogged down again in the Radrizzani 49ers setup, any time Leeds do a transfer, they need money. Unless they're selling players, they need money to come in from shareholders, effectively. There was actually around Ruta some talk about the possibility of offering Hoffenheim a loan obligation deal, you know, saying we'll loan him now, we'll pay a fee for him, we will be obligated to take him in the summer. But our understanding was that the 49ers were quite influential, or 49ers Enterprises were quite influential in saying, no, do you know what, let's just get this done, let's do it permanent, let's sign him, let's get it over the line. So with McKennie, I mean, I don't know how much people will have followed the story with Juventus in Italy at the moment, but they are just coming out the other side of an investigation into alleged financial irregularities, which has led to a 15-point deduction. Hey,
well, yes.
Like old times.
We all shuddered then.
In Serie A.
Juventus have been naughty. I didn't see that coming.
Well, apparently so. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I'm an au fait with the details of this. Neither are you, Daniel.
No. But, they've got no form for this stuff.
but let's just say that you don't tend to get a 15-point deduction for nothing, despite everything that was said in 2007 as well. There have also been sanctions against former club executives. And it is generally a bit of a mess, and they're going to have to restore their balance. And the feeling in Italy, and the message that seems to be coming from Turin and the ownership there, is that they would quite happily take a fee for Weston McKennie at this point. They would quite happily trim him from the wage bill. Wages, I don't think, would be much of an issue for Leeds. I think they would be able to get McKennie done on that front. But as with Unahi, and it's slightly different to Unahi, because Unahi before the World Cup was a £8 million to £12 million player, somewhere in the region of £10 million. This side of the World Cup, repeat myself here, but, you know, £20 to £25 million. And there are examples in the past of it being a flawed strategy to pay big for a player on the basis of one international tournament. Having said that, he looked very good. And it would be, I think, unreasonable to expect that his value wouldn't increase, or a club wouldn't want more money for him based on a very good performance at the World Cup. But that one really hasn't progressed. I think a couple of weeks ago, we were all wondering if that was going to get going, because Leeds were talking about it a lot. But that is in the background and doesn't seem to have moved forward at this stage. The talk this week, the noise this week, has been around about McKennie. But again, you know, it would come, a player Leeds like, 100%, but it would come down to cash.
Feels to me, from a fan point of view, that with what, under a week left of the window now or thereabouts, they're just sitting tight on this one, letting it cook. See what Juventus do, see who blinks first, because, you know, Juventus are going to want Leeds to pony up. Leeds are going to want Juventus to drop their price. It's one of those where everybody just lets it simmer for a while.
This is by no means unusual at Leeds, actually. You almost feel like every window goes like this. And we saw it with Gakpo and Dieng, and Nonto's slightly different because that deal had already been done. It was just supposed to wait for a later window and was brought forward because the Dieng offer fell through. But Gakpo was, you know, an example of that, that at the last minute, suddenly somebody thinks that there's a deal to be done. So having thought, oh, we're finished, or we might not do anything else. And, you know, to go back to Kinnear's programme notes a few days before the window closed, that seemed to be the message. You know, we're done, you know, we're sorted. So at this point in the window, I think you always say to yourself, never say never, because you don't quite know what's going to move. You don't quite know what's going to change, or who's going to be more accommodating in the last few days of the window than they have been up to this stage. Suffice to say, Leeds have done what they wanted to do in this window, primarily. You know, they've done the priorities, which, after a fashion, is a left-back, you know, Max Vuber. Vuber, apparently, actually, somebody was in touch with me saying the umlaut means Vuber. I must ask him. But, well, you know...
if only you had access.
Yeah, shall we pivot to Vuber, do you think, or shall we stick with Vuber?
We got into this on our show this week, didn't we? And we listened to a pronunciation of it, and it seems to be Vuber. Yeah, Vuber.
Vuber. Yeah. Okay, I'm happy with that. So they got Vuber, who is a centre-back historically, but has been left-back for Salzburg before coming here, and in Leeds' mind has provided cover for that position, which they wanted to do. And then Ruta, who, again, you wouldn't pigeonhole as an out-and-out number nine. He can play in other roles, but that is pretty much what he wants to do, and that's what he tends to do. So they've covered the forward area as well, attacking area, which, you know, those were the two key things for them before the window opened. Since Matthijs Kleek was released and allowed to do that deal with DC United, it's kind of felt as if the door has been open for a central midfielder, and that it's really rested. I think McKennie and Unahi are definitely both there to be done if somebody pays the money. But they probably both fall into the category of players that you only want to push the valuation so far.
Yeah, and that's not to suggest that they're both there to be done, like as in both of them.
No, sorry.
Dear Lord, no.
I did actually tweet the piece that I wrote this morning because it there was part of it that kind of implied that they were both going to be peering through the mist, you know. It's like, no. It would be either or. It might conceivably be neither as well. I mean, at this stage, it's definitely not the case that Leeds are saying somebody will absolutely be coming in. But it has felt since Cleek moved on that, yeah, the door's been open to the possibility that would happen. And they've already committed £40 million to this window. So in no way would I suggest that they should unequivocally be pushing the spending to £60 million, £65 million by doing a £20, £25 million midfielder. But I do think that if they were to do that and if they were minded to do it, the squad would be noticeably better for it.
When it comes to the fee on McKennie, do you think the commercial aspect of it maybe will push us to go a little bit higher on it, given the American thing, which I know is annoying some people, but it's he is a good player.
I mean, why does that annoy people, by the way? Because we've got six Spaniards in the squad.
Yeah. And a Scottish journalist writing about them. Yeah. That must be even more annoying.
I do get it. I'm not being disingenuous. Yeah, I understand why people are saying, you know, you could go for other targets if they weren't American, but you're going for those because they are.
Isn't it more the case that it hasn't really worked or gone to plan so far? And so the more investment that there is in this model, the more people are probably going to sit and say, is this wise? Like, is this, you know, the sensible way to go? And as ever, the proof will be in the pudding when this all plays out. It's an interesting question that, because we wrote a long piece for The Athletic before Christmas about Tyler Adams and the impact, or I guess the commercial benefits that there might be to Leeds of having US MNT captain as he is at the moment in the squad in the lead up to 2026, which is obviously based in the States and Canada, the World Cup, States, Canada and Mexico, pretty much a home World Cup for the US. So McKennie would fall into that category as well, another face of the US national squad. But McKennie is probably at the moment more of a visible face in the States, or more of a recognisable face than Adams. You know, speaking to commercial people over there, they were saying it'd be completely wrong to say that Tyler Adams is a household name in America. He just isn't. He's a household name with people who know about football. But to people who don't follow the sport or aren't interested in the sport, there'll be a lot of them who have no real awareness of him at all. Christian Pulisic has always been, in recent years, has been the face of that squad. And, you know, the player that people recognise more than any other. The feeling of people who follow this stuff is that McKennie would be second in the list. And Adams definitely close behind now after the World Cup in Qatar. So yeah, commercially, there could be an upside to that. But here and now, it seems to me that the recruitment you're doing can't really focus. It can't be allowed to be weighted on the basis of what's going to happen in the run-up to the World Cup. It surely has to be based on what the difference is going to be now and, you know, in the short to medium term.
I mean, on the flip side of this, Weston McKennie is a Champions League level footballer.
Yes.
And we probably don't get him without his mates being in Leeds.
I don't know about that. One of my colleagues was onto us all this morning about, you know, wanting to speak to people in Europe about the fact that English clubs seem to be in for every single transfer, and every single good, strong, big transfer, there's an English club involved who quite often have more money than any of the other teams on the continent who are getting involved. And in these circumstances, when was the last time Juventus were this much of a mess, or I guess this week in Italian football? You know, they won't go close to winning the title this year. They've got a hell of a lot to sort out. It feels like the days when they were just kind of rattling off, you know, Scudetto after Scudetto is probably shelved for now, and they're going to have to recover. So, but you're right. I mean, if you're trying to play cards and you're trying to play an ace card, it's not a bad thing having Tyler Adams in the mix.
And you wonder, is there, with things shifting over in the direction of the 49ers, if we are to tiptoe around that one euphemistically, is there going to be more of a willingness maybe just to go that little bit further financially and just maybe get this one over the line, give yourself the best chance of succeeding, of getting out of this? Because like you said, Phil, add McKennie to this midfield and suddenly it's looking like a really strong team and one that you think could play its way out of trouble.
Well, that was the attitude with Ruter, was that it's far better to do it permanently than it is to do it on loan. Although there will have been a financial consideration there as well. in that the 49ers probably did not want to get landed with the full fee. You know, the, if the fee is pushed further down the line, i.e. first installment in the summer rather than now or shortly, then if the club is sold before then it probably falls to them. And I mean, this stuff is, without seeing it on paper, it's incredibly difficult, stroke impossible, to know how this all divvies up between them and Radrazzani. But that said, it, you know, money still comes into play, and there will, I think there'll be some pragmatism applied to this. I get Orta, Victor Orta is one of those people, one of those recruitment people who is always there looking for a deal, And I think likes at the end of the window to say to the club, listen, we could do this, we could do this. This player's come up. This is an opportunity. Why don't we? And then obviously it falls to the people in charge of the money and the accounts to say, yes, we can or no, we can't. So let's see. There's a lot going on, actually. There's plenty happening. There's Leicester, interest from Leicester in Jack Harrison. There is Cody Drammey going out to Luton. That probably be done by the time people listen to this.
On Harrison, is there interest in him signing a contract, though? That's kind of been floated today in the presser.
So with Harrison, his contract ends in 18 months' time. He's beyond the age now and has been for a while where you would be due any compensation if he reaches the end of his deal. And if he gets into the last 12 months, then clearly his value starts to diminish pretty drastically. And that was part of the thinking with Phillips and Rafinha last summer, was that if you were going to sell them, that was the time to do it. You know, from that point onwards, you were never going to get as much as was on offer in that particular window. Leeds quite often do this at this time of year, delay contract talks until after the window's closed so that they don't get tangled up between doing transfers. And I mean, if you think of the amount of time that was devoted in the week that Reuter signed to actually getting that done, the last thing you want is contract talks going on at the same time and having to juggle the two balls. So what normally happens is that the January window closes, and then contract talks, probably see this with Robin Koch as well, can start up and get dealt with. And my understanding is very much that the plan has been, and I think still is, to try to get Harrison tied to a new contract when the window ends. There's a reluctance to sell him to Leicester because of where Leicester are in the table around about them. There's an acceptance that Leicester will pay him more than Leeds would pay him, without any doubt. And there's enough whispering about this at the Leicester end to make me think that Leicester are sort of quietly hopeful that this might fall into place. But Marsh was fairly clear when he was asked about it today that he's important, that they need him. He seemed to be saying without saying
anything. He said that about Click.
I think it was different with Click, though, because with Click, it was that sort of, I guess, abstract tone of, yeah, you know, he's an important part of the squad. I thought he was much stronger and firmer on Harrison today. It didn't in as many words say he won't be leaving, but I thought that's what he was trying to say. I never felt, if you think back with Cleek before the season started up when we asked about him, Marsh said, after the World Cup when the season got going again, Marsh said a few times, yeah, I don't really want to discuss Cleek's future. You know, we've got to see what happens, we've got to see how it all plays out. He was pretty much hinting at the fact that there was an offer on the table and, you know, it might well be that they parted ways. That wasn't really the way it was put with Harrison today, I didn't think. But again, you know, having talked about the unpredictability of the back end of the window, that doesn't only apply to players coming in.
So my next question, Phil, is let's try and ruin your credibility some more and predict what's going to happen over the next 5 to 6 days then before the window closed. Because time next week, we'll be able to reflect on a window that's closed and assess whether it's been good or bad or indifferent or somewhere in between. What do you think is going to happen?
It's as much a mug's game as predicting scorelines, which is why we've stopped this season. I'll not hang myself by predicting. But I think, as I say, the vibes I think are that Harrison will most likely stay, but I am conscious of where he's at with his contract, and I certainly can't speak for him. With McKennie, I feel like Leeds will be very tempted to do it if the price is right.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We'll get into Accrington in a minute, but Bielsa, Everton, what is going on there, Phil? What's on the jungle drums? What are they saying?
We can reasonably not drink Buckfast with this one, I think, because this is an actual live topic of conversation with Bielsa. At the moment, what's going on with him is exactly what you would expect to be going on, which is that Everton, having shown the hand and said, and Mashiri, their owner in particular, and said, we would like Bielsa, it has quickly been shown that you don't appoint him in the space of a day or a couple of days, and that in no time at all, you get drawn into the sort of negotiations that Bielsa insists on having before he takes a job. It's Thursday afternoon. As we speak, there have been reports this afternoon that he's actually in London now. He's travelled to England. I can't honestly say if that's true or not. I don't know, but let's assume that it is. Everton seem to want to have this done, as in have a manager appointed by the weekend, before the weekend. There are strong suggestions over the water that Mexico want Bielsa and that they feel like they might be quite close to doing that. But obviously in the past sort of 3, 4, 5 months, we've seen Bolivia linked with him, Colombia linked with him, Bournemouth have an actual go at trying to appoint him. And at one stage, people in Argentina were suggesting that that was getting pretty close, but it didn't happen. And they ended up appointing Gary O'Neill instead. So we wait to see, really. I mean, the thing about this is that if Bielsa was to pitch up at Goodison Park now, it would be such a massive gear change for him. I mean, to the extent of a kind of, you know, handbrake turn, really. Somebody, I think it was Andrew Haig, tweeted earlier this week, the dates at which Bielsa's taken every club job, he never, ever gets into a job mid-season for obvious reasons. You know, he needs... We always laughed about the fact that when they started playing so well in that first season under him, like exceptionally well, he sort of said, we said, how did you do this? You know, you only had one pre-season, how did you do it? And he was like, well, 5 or 6 weeks was fine for me to do it. And actually, having coached international teams, he felt he was quite good at players coming together and being able to transmit messages and drill them really, really quickly. But he still needed that 5 to 6 weeks. You know, he wasn't pretending that he could have done it without it. And he is absolutely not going to get that at the moment because it's right in the thick of the season and Everton are in deep trouble. And more than one person has said to me, I just think that squad will turn to dust if he starts, yeah. You know,
I mean, like
starts whipping them.
The physical demands, but then the shift to man-to-man marking.
Yes.
I say this late, I know we're only halfway through, but in terms of, it feels like the season is shaping up is what I mean. And we know
it's well on, isn't it? Yeah.
And to ask them to pivot to something as unique as that at this stage is, it's playing with fire, isn't it? But if Mashiri wants Bielsa, then it seems like he's pushing the boat out to get him. I don't want him to do that.
Yeah, but I don't think Mashiri wants, Mashiri gets. If you know what, I just don't think that's how it works with Bielsa. I think there's probably nobody who Bielsa would just say yes to because they're paying him the money or whatever else. It all has to be right. I mean, the one job that he was dead set on taking was the Bilbao job. But the presidential candidate who had backed him and had negotiated with him to take the post didn't win the election. So in the end, it was Valverde who went in there. And, you know, the one thing in my head is, I mean, I'm totally, totally sceptical about this happening, but you'd never rule out anything with Bielsa. You never second guess him particularly. I just think you have to apply everything that you've learned about him. And when you do, you can't really convince yourself that this is going to happen. But I know that he's told people around him that he wants to get back in the game. And actually, having thought that Leeds would probably be the only English club that he would manage, he said to people he would quite happily come back and do another job in the Premier League. It's been a year almost since he went from Leeds, and it's not an extraordinarily long time, but it's taken him on to 67. And I guess if he wants to get back in and wants to coach again, he can't say no to everything, can he? Eventually there's got to be something that works.
I think in different circumstances, Everton does make sense for him because it feels like the sort of club he would go for, kind of working class city,
yeah,
glorious past, all that sort of stuff. But the circumstances he'd be going into seem disastrous for him. It feels like the sort of job he might walk out, might take and then walk out of 2 weeks in.
Yeah, or I can see him not taking it now and then saying, yeah, I'll do it if they go down. Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I always feel with Leeds that it's a city and a club more specifically with a lot of soul, and you two behave here. But the same's true of Liverpool, you know, and I think the same is true of Everton to a large degree as well. He would like, I think, the pretty fervent support that they have. And I think I think he would relate to Liverpool more than he would quite a lot of other cities. I think it would kind of suit him.
I agree. And let me just throw this one at you then. Saturday the 18th of February, Everton against Leeds.
Are you going to say to me, are we going to be playing Bielsa?
No, but I was going to say, like, could you imagine a scenario where it's Everton against Leeds, and let's imagine even if Leeds are winning against Marcelo Bielsa's side, with Jesse Marsh in charge, yet the away end singing Bielsa's name. It makes for some interesting ideas. Well,
on the flip side, Bielsa's in charge and Leeds are losing. You know, that's...
Well, I mean, that would be beyond toxic, wouldn't it?
Yeah. As it stands at the moment, that's going to be a mega fixture. You know, that and Southampton, really, really important. And games that Leeds have got to win.
Let's not do that. It's making me too anxious.
In 2 weeks' time, he's turned Dwight McNeil into Pablo Hernandez.
It's making me too anxious thinking about it. Let's talk about Accrington Stanley, which is happening on Saturday lunchtime. Should be fun, this. I'm sort of looking forward to this. I don't know. Am I a fool?
Yeah, me too, actually.
Am I a fool?
Me too. More than I would have been Boreham Wood, I think. Boreham Wood, it would have felt a bit like Fright Night. Accrington Stanley might be Fright Night, but a colleague of mine that I used to worked with at the Yorkshire Post, Leo Wobshaw, confidently told, he's got away with words, his Wobshaw, but in broad terms, he was saying that Accrington's defence when he watched them against Barnsley was not great.
Yes.
And they're not going particularly great guns in League One either. So, you know, this is there to be won. Marsh given the impression today that he will play a strong team. And actually, surely that the replay against Cardiff is just the blueprint for what to do at this stage of the FA Cup. Play a sensible team, play a strong team, don't mess about. More often than not, that's going to work for you.
Yeah, get it won. Make your subs.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I'm looking forward to. Jorginho, we're going to see him.
It sounds like he might start, which would be good. Yeah, really looking forward to seeing him and seeing what he's about.
Don't you think his signing is kind of, and this talk of McKennie in particular, I think McKennie would build on it, but it's been the catalyst for the sense that Leeds United has started its engine again recently.
Yeah, it's
where
point, I think.
I think we'd kind of, we'd hit a point of stasis under the current ownership and the feeling that we were living a little bit hand to mouth. And that, you know, they did quite a bit of business in the summer, but it was always kind of against the backdrop of we've sold these two players to fund these lot. It feels like it's kind of just that the engine is just turning again now and we're starting to move forward potentially.
I feel like the unexpected joy of Willie Nonto has brought a lot of that as well. It's enthused people again.
Yeah, I don't feel that Leeds have a crop of bad players at all. The defence is a concern, definitely. But Ruiter is a big signing. You know, he is. Whether you knew him or not, or knew anything about him or not, it's transfer record. And on that basis, it's a club pushing the boat out to get that done. And, you know, second half of the season is going to be, it's going to be absolutely critical Leeds finding good form at some point, as in winning games at some point. So he has to be central to that in the way that Nonto does as well. Nonto will be absolutely key, I think, between now and May. But this could be a really good game just to get, you know, just to start the fire with Ruiter, I think. And hopefully, good result. If it's not raining on Saturday, I'll be comfortable.
Wiping moisture off the lens of the camera and all that, from a garden shed on top of the stand. Yeah,
I've written for today, if you're listening on Friday, basically about the FA Cup banter years at Leeds. So, you know, from Heston to Sutton and Newport and everything else. And I got in touch with Ben Parker about the Heston game. And Parker was saying he was really angry beforehand because he expected to play. Alan Sheen had been injured. Parker had been in at left back. Thought, oh, you know, it's on the telly, I'll get a game of this. Gary McAllister said to him on the morning of the game, you're on the bench, Sheehan's going to play. So Parker said, you know, I was absolutely fuming about this. But then we got to Heston and I thought, I might have dodged the bullet here. Because he said, in his view, his opinion is, and I find it very difficult to disagree with this, had it not been on the telly, I don't think that game would have gone ahead. It's still surprising me that it went ahead. Because honestly, we sat and typed afterwards. And by the time we went, it was pitch black and it rained and it rained and it rained. And as we were leaving the ground, you could hardly see a blade of grass on the pitch. It was like a swimming pool in front of you. But as Parker said, it wasn't like we could all come out and blame that and say, oh, never mind, you know. So there was just that horrible moment in the second half where you're sitting watching, having gone from, you know, we'll have the quality to dig this out to, we are banging trouble here, banging trouble. And I remember my wife messaged me because I popped up randomly on the TV feed, just the camera. Camera was looking at Eddie Gray and I happened to be sitting behind Eddie in the press box and there's about 5 minutes to go. And my wife sent me a message saying, cheer up. And I messaged her back saying, they're in deep shit here. They are in real, real danger of about the worst defeat you could possibly imagine. And yeah, happy memories of the postman heading in.
Although Jesse was praising the pitch today, actually, wasn't he, at Accrington? So hopefully less of an issue.
Yes, I haven't seen it myself, but hopefully it is decent.
I did see somebody tweeting, kind of patronising things about Accrington Stanley, and an Accrington fan bit back and said, we're a League One club, you know, we're not in the blooming Sunday League here.
I think there's quite, it sounded like a battle, the replay with Boreham Wood, but it's not the same thing. You know, Accrington are a Football League side, Boreham Wood aren't. And the odds say that Leeds should come through this. It's not a particularly recognisable squad at Accrington Stanley. They've got Delfonso, who you might remember was at Aston Villa back in the day, and was one of those players that was sort of perennially linked with Leeds on loan through the Simon Grayson era. The top scorer is a guy called Tommy Lee. Not that one. He scored the winner.
Have you seen a lot of him?
yes, analysed him to death. Yeah, I'll give John Miller a shout later on, he'll know. But I think it's been a hard season for them so far. They've not got much momentum, haven't had much impetus in League One. But the fact that it's away from home makes it a far more dangerous game than if it was at Elland Road, I think.
And we know as well, Angus Kinnear has been leaning on Jesse Marsh, telling him to get us through in the cups. So it feels like there has been, definitely off the back of that first Cardiff game, perhaps a reinforcing of that message where he's saying, listen, we really would like to do something this year.
I'm not saying that they haven't taken any interest in the cup previously, but it feels like this is the first season in a long time where it's actually been part of the strategic aim for the season, you know, is to make proper progress. And the FA Cup has been quite damaging for certain managers over the years. I think Bielsa at Crawley was, and that, I mean, that was a really poor defeat and very poor performance and a really odd day because he left players at home and big players at home. He made what looked like pre-decided substitutions, which didn't work, it didn't help. And you know, in the end, they just got completely outgunned by Crawley, which was weird. But there weren't really any sleep lost about that. Don't get me wrong, you know, people wanted to make progress, but they were going through a good Premier League season. They were midway through it at that point. So it was just one of those things. But Thomas Christensen, the defeat that he suffered at Newport County was definitely part of his slide towards the sack, without any question. If you look at McAllister's record, you know, Heston was a problematic point, which did not get any better from there. You know, he was gone. That was early December. He was gone by Christmas. And then there was Gary Monk at Sutton, you know, that kind of famous, infamous lineup. And him sort of saying afterwards, it felt as if the whole thing was about transfers, you know, the transfers that he wanted doing and which weren't happening. And I remember us asking him afterwards, you know, what do you expect to happen in the last couple of days of the window? Because we were right close to the deadline at that point. To which he just said, well, you'd be better off asking the club than me. And I mean, you know, that's a classic example of a manager saying not very happy.
We've done a full episode on that.
Have you?
Yeah, we made it to what, about 23 minutes as well. 23 minutes talking just about that game.
Artificial
very little
pitch.
About the game, really.
Yeah.
It was just, we were just terrible. Yeah. Was the short version just of what happened during the game.
Just confused by the lineup. Confused by the outcome. Just everything was confusing.
I mean, the feeling of Leeds at Newport with Christensen was that it was just asking for trouble, that lineup, but not quite to the extent that Marsh's was. Gary Monk's. Monk seemed set up to lose. I think Christensen wanted to go there, hopefully win the game, but didn't want to risk many first-team players. And of course, there was the unbelievable backfire of deciding at late notice that actually we'll take Saez and stick him on the bench. And then Saez comes on and gets sent off for spitting and gets a 6-game ban. The whole thing was just, you know, it was just a debacle, really. But, you know, these games can do quite a lot of damage to you if you're not careful. And I was saying last week that I'd bumped into a Leeds fan last week who said he'd put money on Leeds to win the cup. I think it was 40-1 and put a fiver on. And
so if you bet a fiver, you lose a fiver.
Well, yes, you might say that. But you see, his rationale was that it's Accrington or Boreham Wood next, so there's a fair chance that Leeds win that tie. And then after that, it starts to come down to the draw, doesn't it? Yeah. Who you land. And sometimes if you get a good draw where you come up against lower league opposition, then you can expect to progress. And if you don't get terrible draws, then it really comes down to how you perform on the day. And if you do show up and if you do, you know, you do play well, then you really have got a chance of getting further down the line. It would be nice. I say I've covered very little. I've covered isolated games, which have been great. You know, Old Trafford as an example, and Arsenal around about that time, and Tottenham as well. But very little in the way of an actual, you know, sustained cup run.
It does look like the cup is quite open this year as well. I mean, I know you always inevitably come up against one of the European Super League teams in the last, you know, well, either the final or the last four, but you're going to lose either Man City or Arsenal.
Yes.
At this stage, which takes care of one of the big boys. And then, you know, Brighton could potentially beat Liverpool the way things are shaping up. It looks quite open, actually, this draw.
So we get to lose to Brighton instead, is that what you're...
I mean, won't that hurt? That'd be a dreadful day out at Wembley, won't it?
Bear in mind as well that as you get further into the season, clubs have to get their priorities in order. And we shouldn't pretend that Leeds might not have to either, because obviously not by no means safe and secure in the table at the moment. But to use City and Arsenal as examples, I mean, City in particular have so much depth, this doesn't tend to be a massive problem for them. But there will come a point at which absolutely everything at both clubs, and I think Arsenal in particular, is focused on the title. You know, absolutely everything is aimed at that, because that's the only thing that really is going to matter to them as they get into the running. Likewise, you've got clubs who'll be in Europe and trying to finish top four and all sorts. So I almost feel like if you can kind of sneak up quietly on the rails through a few rounds, then you just never know.
I was just looking at Wigan's run to the final, and ultimately they obviously beat Man City, which was a massive upset. But to get there, they played Bournemouth, Macclesfield, Huddersfield, Everton and Millwall. That'd be doable.
Yeah.
Why can't we have a nice run?
Well, 3rd of June, that's the date for the cup final. And I looked because my birthday is always around the sort of cup final, kind of Champions League final day. And I miss it by a few days, which is for the best, I think, because the playoff final, the Doncaster one at Wembley, was my dad's birthday.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, we'd have been another walk in summer, and I did plan around the FA Cup.
When you say we...
Well, Phil is definitely doing it.
It was a royal wee. Yeah, thanks for coming on board again, Phil, and lending us your support.
But yeah, I did look at the FA Cup date. I thought, I know it's almost certainly completely irrelevant to this,
but
just in case, let's put it the week after.
Can you imagine?
What, Leeds in the FA Cup final?
About three people show up for the walk. Yeah.
Oh, dear me. I mean, let's walk before we run, I would say.
Absolutely.
But just, you can just dream.
Stay in it, and then it adds a bit of fun to the season. Like Michael was saying about Nonto, you know, the little bits that keep you engaged and the kind of bright sparks that every single club needs. And if at some point you can ally that with improved form in the league and some results that make it far more comfortable, then potentially you could be in for quite a nice, happy second half of the season.
Some moments to celebrate.
Yes.
That's what we're looking for, Jesse.
And some breaking news. How's this? We're doing breaking news.
Oh, go on.
There are picture exclusives that the Mail is putting out just now. People will know this if they're listening. Obviously after the event, but Marcelo Bielsa arriving at Heathrow Airport.
Wow.
Pictured, photographed.
Yes. Well, it has to be said that he would not be coming to England for a laugh, really. So very much, very much watch this space.
Well, interesting times ahead. We'll watch that one, won't we? And we will join you again on Monday.
We didn't even touch on the aspect of Bielsa taking over from Lampard, did we?
I mean, it's too delicious.
After all of that.
The problem is, though, that given where we are in the table and where Everton are in the table, it's too close for comfort, isn't it, I think? We'll laugh about it at the end of the season.
He looks in such good shape.
He does, doesn't he?
Just looking at him walking through the lounge there, yeah, he's properly shed weight and he's properly kept it off. He's given the photographer a proper quality glare as well, isn't he? Like, who are you? Yeah, I mean, it's
nice to see him still wears Adidas as well, religiously.
Absolutely extraordinary story, if it happens, it really would be. And as I say, just so different to any job he's taken on previously, the circumstances of it. So let's see.
Monday, you and I, Phil, then we will debrief the FA Cup game at Accrington. Yes. We'll speak to you then.
Thank you very much. The Phil Hay Show.